yesterday in speaking about the three perceptions, impermanent, unreliable, not self. Gil mentioned this very deep level of freedom that's possible through the seeing of these perceptions at a very deep level, seeing the impermanent nature of experience. Our mind understands. It doesn't make any sense to cling. Wisdom understands it doesn't make any sense to cling. Wisdom is a quality in the mind that grows as we practice, as we observe our experience in this way suggested by the Buddha, this non-judgmental allowing awareness. Wisdom about these three perceptions grows and strengthens, and that wisdom supports this recognition that clinging is not the way to happiness. There's a phrase in the suttas that happens a fair amount, something along the lines of, and one is liberated through non-clinging. One of those passages. And how has one comprehended the Dhamma? One sees as it really is with correct wisdom. This has come to be. Having seen as it really is with correct wisdom, this has come to be. Through disenchantment towards what has come to be, through its fading away and cessation, one is liberated by non-clinging. And again, it is through the deep understanding, direct experiential understanding, not intellectual understanding, direct experiential understanding of impermanent, unreliable, not self, that this disenchantment with impermanent phenomena, disenchantment with unreliable phenomena comes to be. So this passage points to a couple of parts of the process, essentially. A couple of extra words here we haven't really mentioned, although in some ways we've been indirectly pointing to these words. Disenchantment and dispassion. Through disenchantment, through its fading away, this word fading away, dispassion, and cessation, one is liberated through non-clinging. And so I want to explore these pieces of the process, this natural development of wisdom. A part of that development of wisdom comes through becoming disenchanted. Disenchanted that with that the usual ways that we have engaged in finding happiness. Wisdom begins to realize, as the wisdom grows, we begin to realize that those habitual ways of finding happiness are not very reliable, are not very satisfactory. We come to understand that the usual ways that we've had of finding happiness are not really the way to happiness. seeing the impermanent nature of experience, we understand there actually isn't anything to hold on to. That trying to hold on to it, it is inherently unreliable because it is impermanent, because it's passing away. And that the kind of believing that it's useful to hold on because we think it's going to do something for me, that sense of me is also exposed as a misperception. And so we've had these perceptions that things have been permanent, reliable, self. And these are exposed as misperceptions. As they're exposed as misperceptions, our mind begin to realize or recognize this is that it has been enchanted, or it has been under the illusion of permanence. It's been under the illusion that there's something out there reliable to land on, and under the illusion of self. And so a piece of this unfolding of our practice is becoming disillusioned, seeing clearly. And this word disenchantment is about this part of the practice of becoming disillusioned. This process of becoming disillusioned is sometimes a challenging experience. It's like we're beginning to understand, you know, that this enchantment is not viable, it's not what it purports to be. And to some extent, you know, we don't like seeing that. You know, it doesn't, some part of us at a deep level wants there to be something reliable, wants there to be something permanent, that, oh yeah, there's got to be some place out there that I can land and like find that happiness. Find that place or that identity or that someplace where there would be something reliable. And so this process of becoming disenchanted, we go through a lot of kind of emotional relationships to seeing that what we've taken to be permanent is impermanent, seeing that we've taken to be reliable is unreliable, seeing that what we've taken to be self is not self. The term that's translated as disenchantment, the Pali term nibbida, can sometimes be translated by the word revulsion. I don't particularly like that translation because it, in our English language, it conveys a kind of an aversive quality. And to me, disenchantment is more like bursting that bubble of ignorance. It's got that understanding of, yeah, this is not what reality is. And yet sometimes one of the flavors that can come along for us as that bubble begins to be burst is a feeling of kind of disgust. It's like, yeah, there's nothing here for me. Where I thought there was something, there isn't. And so sometimes the feeling, so there's a lot of different flavors that can of relationship to this disenchantment, you know, as our minds begin to see that they've been enchanted and are losing that enchantment. There are some different flavors of almost emotional response to that. And this quality or flavor of revulsion, it might have that flavor. I've experienced it at times, just like, oh, enough. It's... ugh. Other flavors can be, you know, the flavor of just like a fear of recognizing that we've had this illusion that there was some place out there reliable to land. And that's like, what? There's not? And the mind is kind of like, no, there's got to be. And so there can be a kind of a sense of fear there. One of my Burmese teachers said that this another relationship to this disenchantment, you know, in this becoming disenchanted with the way we thought things were, another flavor of that is a feeling like of homesickness. And this flavor to me has come like in the sense of, oh, I wish I could go back to that like belief. You know, I just, it's like, it felt so cozy to think there was some place that was home. It felt so good to think that. And now I don't have that home to go back to anymore. And there's kind of a sense of that, a feeling of a loss of some kind of a sense of home or safety, even as we understand that it was not a true refuge, as it was not a true place. But still we have that kind of feeling of homesickness. Sometimes the flavor can be like boredom. And just seeing, for instance, as we start to see just how rapidly things change, and that there's just this never-ending impingement of experience and no place reliable to land and nothing to do with it, but just experience it. It's like, okay, seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, touching, seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, touching, stuff in the mind. Yep. So there can be a kind of a feeling of boredom or disinterest, like the mind just gets disinterested in the phenomena. For me, this was a particularly challenging point in the practice because interest had been so strong and there'd been a little bit of attachment and delight in that interest. And it's like, oh, it's just all the same stuff over and over and over again. So the mind began to lose interest. This is a little bit of that flavor of disenchantment. That interest to some extent had been predicated on some view about what was happening or some sense that it would bring me happiness. So there are so many different relationships to this discovery that we've been enchanted and becoming disillusioned. And the way through this time, the way exploring in this time as our minds are beginning to recognize these truths at this very deep level is to recognize the relationships. You know, that's what's arising. Those relationships are kind of like very deep kind of resistance to those truths. That they're expressions of how we don't want those truths of impermanent, unreliable, not self to be true. And so just noticing this is that relationship, that fear, that homesickness. And so this terrain of becoming disillusioned can feel a little bumpy, can feel a little bit challenging in the practice. And yet, as we become disillusioned, it moves in the direction of real freedom. The mind begins to become dispassionate. And again, this word maybe needs a little bit of reflection, because just the word dispassion, we might think, well, I don't want that. You know, I want to have care and connection and love, and the feeling of dispassion feels somehow like not feeling. It feels disconnected somehow. And yet what this is pointing to is the kind of release from the ways that we've been caught. It's a fading away of craving, of clinging. It's a release from what has been creating suffering. And in the experience in dispassion, the experience as the mind really connects to what is actually happening, is not a sense of nothing matters, which may be what we have a sense of the word dispassion is like, oh yeah, nothing matters. But rather is more of a sense of connectedness, because those things that keep us from connection, greed, aversion, and delusion keeps us from connection. Those have fallen away. And there's an arising of love and care and concern for self, for others. And so this word dispassion, I don't know if there's another word that might evoke more that quality of not being hooked. Not being hooked in the way we've been hooked. But that place where we're not hooked by greed, aversion, and delusion is a place of deep care and connection. Compassion is possible with dispassion. Compassion is more available with dispassion. The word dispassion, the word for dispassion, viraga, has a couple of different qualities nuances to it. The word evokes the fading of dye. The word viraga is actually, I think, used in that sense. That if there's a cloth that has dye on it and it is set out into the sun, that cloth will gradually lose its color. And this is, the term viraga has that quality of losing, fading. Sometimes it's translated as fading out. In that passage that I read, through fading away, through disenchantment towards what has come to be, through fading away and cessation, one is liberated by non-clinging. That fading away is this word dispassion. And if we think about this image of a cloth that is fading, you know, it fades maybe because we put it in soap and some of the soap pulls out some of the dye. We dry it in the sun and maybe it bleaches a little bit in the sun, and so some of the dye fades that way. Multiple washings, more dye fades. The fading process of a cloth is a very gradual one. And I think that's an important image to hold in mind with this with reflecting on the trajectory of our path. I used to have this sense, or this belief, maybe it was a belief, that there would be some moment some big bang moment in my practice where I would suddenly know everything and there would be no more suffering after that point, and it would be really clear that that had happened. You know, enlightenment, it's like, sounds like something that's a sudden thing, a sudden kind of change in our minds. But this image here that the Buddha uses in this very, in the process of this experience of freedom is fading. The fading of dye in a cloth. It's a gradual process. Many, many washings, many putting out into the sun. We might think about our mindfulness practice as being, you know, maybe the mindfulness is like the soap, and the energy, the wise effort is like the agitation, you know, and it's like those, the processes of mindfulness and energy together, turning away at our hindrances and our sticky stuff. It's a slow process. It's a gradual process. The Buddha emphasized over and over again the gradual nature of this path. There are some descriptions in the teachings of people who had sudden realization, sudden arising of understanding. But usually that happened after a long period of time of practice. So it might seem at times like there's a sudden kind of splitting or a sudden kind of seeing, but usually that's happened because there's been a lot of preparation, a lot of work. And so it might seem sometimes like there's this gradual fading that maybe we can't see it day to day, but, you know, this cloth that I've got here, you know, it used to be really, really, really dark, and it's getting more and more faded, and I know that it's fading, but I don't see how much it fades each time I put it in the wash. You know, it's just a little bit lighter, but I know that there's some of it that's worn away, some of it that's faded away. So sometimes we can kind of have a sense of a very gradual weakening. We might have a sense of that in our practice, kind of reflecting back over 5 years or 10 years. Yeah, I'm not as caught by that thing as I used to be. So we might have a sense of that. But every now and then there may be something, some experience where it feels like something opens and cleaves open and we see something suddenly. Gil gave an analogy about this some years ago that really struck with me. He talked about chopping wood. You have a log that you want to split for the fireplace. You stand it on end and you bring that hatchet down and nothing happens. When I was a teenager, I loved to split wood at the campground. It was one of my favorite things to do. And so I really resonated with this image. So I would do this and it wouldn't break. And I'd do it again and it wouldn't break. And then at some point it would split. And be like, oh, I did it just right that time. Whatever I did that time, that was the thing I was supposed to do. That was the right way to do it. That can be what we might think there. But if we, you know, reflect on what's going on there, you know, every single time that hatchet comes down on the log, it weakens the fibers in the log. Not perceptible from the outside, but happening nonetheless. And that 58th time that you come down on it and it splits, it wouldn't have happened except for those prior 57 times. And so this gradual nature of the fading nature, the gradual nature of the path, it's important to reflect on. And over the course of our practice, it's almost like different levels of things can fade. We might notice a fading of certain kinds of reactivity. You know, certain you know obvious forms of aversion or anger or wanting certain things, you know, fall away. But there's still greed and aversion in the mind. It's just at a subtler level. And that, maybe then at that point when the bigger ones have fallen away, there's more availability of the mind to actually see some of the subtler kinds of clinging, some of the subtler kinds of greed and aversion. And then maybe those begin to fall away. And maybe at a certain point, there's a kind of an attachment to the pleasantness that we have in meditation or concentration. And you know, it's like, well, this is a wholesome thing. And yet there's a little bit of clinging to it. And maybe we start to see that. And so there can be these like stages or levels of attachment that begin to weaken through. I mean, the mechanism or the way it works is that, well, let's just, you know, imagine this part, like early in practice, maybe we have a lot of reactivity. You know, I worked with a lot of anger, and very painful, very searing kind of self-hatred, anger at others. And when I first started meditating, it's like getting a little bit of concentration and settledness and peace. It's like, oh, that feels pretty good. And it created conditions that let me have some stability of mind to be able to work with that anger. Maybe there was some attachment to that stability of mind in those states and that concentration. And yet that was allowing the letting go, or allowing the mind to begin to release the bigger kinds of attachments. And then as those bigger ones began to fall away, much less of that big reactivity in my life, then the kind of the clinging to, I've got to be a good meditator, I've got to have my teachers approve of me, that began to be really painful. But when there was the pain of the anger and the self-hatred, that other kind of pain wasn't as obvious. And so there's a kind of a staged letting go, like levels or layers of things that we let go of. So this fading away, you know, we can have this sense of something fading away or having been seen through. And it seems so clear at times in our practice when we've seen something, this is not worth clinging to. Or, wow, this is just a thought arising in the mind. It's got no power. You know, self-hatred for me was that. At one point, seen so clearly, this is just a thought. The mind is thinking. It's not got any reality to it except what the mind gives it. In that seeing of it, it was so clear that self-hatred had no traction in that moment. Seen through, faded away, actually released very quickly in that moment. Sometimes that can happen. We can get a quick release of something in our experience. And yet that seeing through, and it seems so clear in the moment. It's like, oh yeah, how can I not see this? It's just so obvious that it's just a thought in the mind. And yet, a couple hours later, that habit, the mind is not seeing clearly in that moment. And the habit, the delusion kind of comes back. The mind, the ignorance, the being enchanted returns. Only this time we know we're enchanted because we've seen that it's a fiction. We've seen that it's enchantment and not something that's really valid. And so there's the kind of that kind of seeing through and the fading away of, or the, you know, the release from a particular kind of suffering can, we can see it clearly, and then the conditions change and it comes back. It's not that you didn't actually see something clearly. I said conditions changed, and the habit, the momentum of that pattern is strong. The habit, the momentum of the ways that we've engaged is very strong. And so and yet the having seen through it, it's like having seen through that, having been disenchanted for that moment, then when we are seeing it again, it's like we're seeing, oh, this is enchantment happening. This is ignorance at work. The mind is confused right now. And so that falling away, when it comes back, there's the possibility and opportunity of beginning to understand how ignorance works much more clearly, how delusion works much more clearly. Because we can see delusion at work now, because it has fallen away. We can now know this is actually a delusional mind. It's not clearly seeing. And so this kind of movement happens in practice where something falls away and we see clearly, and then we're not seeing clearly. But we know we're not seeing clearly now. And that's a big difference. And so this is part of the gradual nature of the path. So the fading of the dye analogy isn't exactly like perfect, because it's kind of like the dye fades and then some of the dye comes back. The dye fades some more and then some of the dye comes back. And so this opening to freedom, opening to dispassion, actually takes us right through those things that we're hooked to, those things that we're stuck to. So it's not a mistake when we're like noticing the stuckness. There's a quote from Bhikkhu Bodhi about this, you know, this process of touching into freedom. And the word dispassion actually is sometimes equated with nibbana, freedom, release. There's I'll read one where do I have one of those in here? I guess I don't have that quote here. Oh, here it is. This is peaceful. So this is a definition of freedom, or a way it's described. This is peaceful. This is the sublime. That is the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all attachments, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. And so here in this definition or this description, the word for dispassion and the word nibbana are kind of offered as synonyms. And so the freedom, the release, the letting go, the fading of that, those attachments, that the movement to non-clinging is a freedom. Other definition of freedom, one of the most common descriptions or definitions of nibbana is the absence of greed, the absence of aversion, the absence of delusion. This is nibbana. Sometimes it can be framed the non-arising of greed, the non-arising of aversion, the non-arising of delusion. This is nibbana. And so dispassion, we might think about dispassion. The movement of dispassion is the movement towards the non-arising of clinging. Maybe we can feel into this, what this might mean. The process of maturation kind of points to, you know, that we let go of things as we grow up. You know, it's like that the mind just doesn't get as, it's not as interested in the things it was interested in when we were kids. And so trying to feel into this, thinking about a time in childhood, some toy that, you know, when you were 5 years old, what was your favorite toy? And how was it when you couldn't have that toy? You know, just that, the attachment to it, the kind of delight that you got with it. You know, where is that? You probably haven't thought about that toy in years. And there are times as we age, you know, growing up, certain toys, you know, we may have a little bit, the attachment to those toys may weaken a little bit slowly. We begin to get a little bit disinterested in them, and we go back. It's like, check it out again. It's like, oh yeah, not as interesting anymore. And, or maybe another friend comes along and wants to play with that toy too. And so we get interested in it for a little while again, but then, you know, we're 12 now and we're not so interested in that. In that chutes and ladders anymore or whatever. And so the mind just begins to lose interest in that. And so that's the process of disenchantment. It's that losing interest in it. And then now as an adult, thinking back on that toy or that thing, it's like disinterest or interest is not relevant around that toy. It's not that we're not interested in it, it's just it's not even arising in the mind as something to have disinterest in. It is just not sticky at all. This is the flavor of dispassion. The mind not picking up clinging. And again, coming through the real deep understanding that there isn't anything to pick up. That what we thought there was to pick up. You know, it's like this this process of seeing our how our minds think something is worth picking up. Something that our minds think, oh, that's a useful, you know, I'm going to hold on to that. You know, that process of clinging to something, that's a mental activity. It's our minds doing that clinging. And, oh yeah, that's good. I'll hold on to that. And so that clinging, that holding on to, and we begin to feel the squeezing of that clinging and the suffering of that clinging, and the mind understands that that's not so helpful, that suffering of that clinging. And so the suffering, we see that the suffering is created by the mind doing that squeezing, that clinging, that holding. And we also start to see, as we really look at what the mind is holding to, or trying to hold on to, is that, as Gil, I think, said the other day, you know, what the mind is holding on to is not the thing itself. Because the thing, the actual experience is nothing that can be held on to because it's changing so rapidly. But our minds have created an idea of something. And so what we're holding on to is the idea. So not only is the suffering, the clinging, which creates the suffering created by our minds, but the thing that we're clinging to is created by our minds. And our minds begin to understand this so deeply that both the suffering and what we're clinging to are mind made. And the wisdom growing understands and recognizes that the mind is creating its own suffering and it begins to let it go. And this is that fading, that dispassion. And so this quote from Bhikkhu Bodhi that I was referring to about this process of realizing the freedom, and the word that he's using here is realizing the unconditioned. Another framing for this freedom. And so Bhikkhu Bodhi says, though the realization of the unconditioned, so the realization of freedom, the realization of non-clinging, requires a turning away from the conditioned, it must be emphasized that this realization is achieved precisely through the understanding of the conditioned. Freedom cannot be reached, nibbana cannot be reached by backing off from a direct confrontation with samsara, with reality, to lose oneself in a blissful oblivion to the world. The path to liberation is a path of understanding, of comprehension, not of escapism and emotional self-indulgence. Nibbana can only be attained by turning one's gaze towards the world and scrutinizing it in all its starkness. The understanding of the conditioned is the way to the unconditioned. We meet the suffering, connect with that. That is how the mind begins to learn and understand. The mind has to, the wisdom has to grow. The wisdom is what allows the mind to let go. The wisdom does the letting go. We cannot figure out how to let go. I've sat in the midst of some kind of real kind of clinging and pain and craving in my mind, understanding that letting go of it would be such freedom. And I remember in that sitting, just almost screaming in my mind, I would let go if I knew how to let go. I don't know how to let go. And that is true many times. And when that's happening, what we explore is, can I hold the not letting go with some measure of acceptance? We can't do the letting go. Wisdom does that. Wisdom lets the clinging go. So this kind of talking about freedom, maybe it seems remote or, you know, not in this sitting anyway. And yet, we can begin to taste wisdom. That wisdom that does the letting go. We can begin to directly experience wisdom at work. We experience it more than you might think. Just these little kind of hints of moments when the mind lets go. Just moments of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. Joseph says they actually happen a lot, quoting Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, who says, anyone can see that if states of greed, aversion, and delusion were with us all day and all night, every second without ceasing, living things would either die or become insane. Let us consider that we survive because there are moments that the fires of greed, aversion, and delusion are not burning. And Joseph points out that while this happens to us, it's like we don't recognize them. Like the moments of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion are kind of subtle, so we don't recognize them. And so this this kind of exploration around where are there moments of little tastes of freedom? Where is wisdom working? This actually is a way that we can encourage wisdom to grow. As with any wholesome quality, when we are aware of its appearance, it creates the conditions for it to grow. We talked about that with the when we talked about the wholesome and the unwholesome, mindfulness having this amazing, wonderful quality of when we attend to things that are unwholesome, it tends to create the conditions for the mind to let go of them, for them to weaken, for them to appear less frequently. When we attend to the wholesome, when we recognize love at work, when we recognize the arising of patience and kindness and mindfulness, we recognize the arising of wisdom. It strengthens that quality in the mind. And so wisdom is an active quality. It is a function. It is something that works. And we can see this. We can see wisdom at work. I'm going to go through a few ways, not all by any means, but just a few kinds of ways that you may see wisdom working. You've probably experienced several of these already. And you may not have kind of quite tuned into, oh, that was wisdom working. So a lot of you have talked about how, seeing something challenging in experience. And a lot of this wisdom at work is seen through the meeting of the struggle. You know, so we see, we meet something. We connect to the arising of some kind of reactivity. And we see, oh, this is just frustration arising. We begin to feel the difference between being caught in frustration and just simply knowing, oh, this is frustration. This is the human experience of frustration. Feels like a little bit of space around it. That's wisdom at work. That experience of the space around some kind of struggle, that's wisdom working. We might at times see the conditioned nature of experience. We might see, being out walking, for instance, feeling the cold, and then suddenly seeing this kind of almost dominoes falling of, oh, it's cold. Oh, I want to be warm. Oh, let me go in and have a cup of warm tea. And then you find yourself kind of walking inside. But having seen these kind of intentions unfolding, watching this conditioned nature, and it's almost like you're watching this happen and not, you recognize, did I ever decide to go in and get a cup of tea? Or did that just happen? And so we can sometimes see that, the process of choice unfolding and recognize that what I had thought was me deciding something was simply a set of conditions unfolding. I'm beginning to point to the conditioned nature of the arising of the sense of self. So this kind of seeing is wisdom at work. Or we might see that if there's a reaction to somebody, you know, you're looking at somebody across the room and they're doing something and there's some kind of judgment or maybe it's self-judgment of like, oh, you know, they're doing it so perfectly and I'm not doing it so perfectly. Or so there's something that's seen and then there's some kind of a judgment. And we might typically think, well, it's something about them that's making this judgment happen. But we might also begin to see that there's the seeing, and then there's some memories and thoughts and views and beliefs and opinions that are arising in connection with that person. And that is where the judgment is coming from, not from the person. It's like it's mediated through these opinions and views. It's conditioned based on opinions and views. Again, the seeing of that, the witnessing of that is wisdom working. Sometimes we might see, and this happens sometimes, it's a when there's a struggle or a difficulty arising, you know, maybe anger arising, you know, often it has that, when we are mindful of it, it has that quality of just having a little space around it. But sometimes there can be such a clear seeing of the arising of something. I described a few minutes ago the self-hatred that I explored, and then at some moment seeing in the moment, just in a moment, seeing that arising of self-hatred was simply a thought arising in the mind that was being believed. And so in that seeing of that, seeing that this is just a thought and it's being believed, and this is the mind believing it. It's like there's no inherent anything here. It's just the believing that's going on. The seeing of that, that self-hatred vanished just in a split second. And so sometimes that can happen when there's wisdom. Some wisdom can be so potent that some kind of reactivity just like goes poof. But I'd say that this is again just one form of wisdom at work. It doesn't mean that the other form where we're actually hanging out with and knowing, oh yeah, this is self-hatred arising, oh, this is painful, it doesn't mean that that's any less valid. Because sometimes what the wisdom needs to work with is that landing in that suffering of that experience. The mind, the wisdom grows in contact with suffering. Because the mindful connection with dukkha helps our mind to realize that dukkha, that arising, that suffering is created by the mind, is kind of optional, and is not well-being. You know, we're beginning to see through the enchantment that somehow that pattern is going to do something for me. We've been caught so many times by this delusion that this pattern of some kind of reactivity is going to make me feel better. By being angry at somebody else, I'm going to feel better. And so that we've almost missed the actual direct experience of the suffering of the anger in this moment. We've not seen it. And so the seeing of it, the experiencing, oh, this is the arising of anger here. This is painful. This is not well-being. That is an education that allows wisdom to grow, allows it to start to release that suffering. And so sometimes there can be a quick disappearance. Something just vanishes. It can be kind of startling. Or we might, over time, begin to kind of recognize that certain kinds of patterns or habits of reactivity have just fallen away. You know, looking back over 10 years, it's like, and I've heard several of you say things like this, that my life is so much more easeful. There's so much more love and joy and connection. I'm happy most of the time. I didn't used to be happy. That certainly was my experience. I used to be so miserable. Just that was my main navigation through the world, was being miserable. And I don't know when that disappeared, or, you know, it was the fading of that. That was the fading. And so sometimes looking back, we can see that something has faded. We can recognize that's not arising anymore. We're recognizing the non-arising of a reactivity. It's beautiful to recognize that. It's wholesome to recognize that suffering is no longer arising. That recognition can create joy create a sense of delight, create a sense of confidence in the path, in the practice. Yes, this is the path. This is supporting the mind to move towards ease, towards peace, towards freedom. So this freedom is to tie it back to the original kind of opening dharmet that Gil gave around a wise one as one with concern for self, for others, for both. Concern for the world, concern for the welfare, concern for the welfare of self, of others, of both, and of the world. And so how does this non-clinging translate into that? I think the word concern might be more active in a way than maybe what results when the mind just doesn't pick up clinging anymore. The description of a person who is free. The Buddha says, when one possesses 10 qualities, I describe them as accomplished in wholesome, an ascetic attained to the supreme attainment. One possesses the right view of one beyond training, the right intention of one beyond training, the right speech, right action, right livelihood of one beyond training, the right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration of one beyond training, the right knowledge, and the right release of one beyond training. So this is a description of the free mind in a way. That there are these qualities no longer needing to be, they're possessed. They don't need to be cultivated anymore. They're the kind of the manifestation of the non-clinging is a being in the world who engages with care, engages with wise speech and wise action, who understands non-clinging, freedom, release. And so the movement, this direction of dispassion, the release, the not picking up of clinging anymore, is the natural kind of unfolding of that mind is a being who lives with care for the welfare of the world, not by any, it's just the nature. We can just say that. It's just the nature of that being to care. Not with clinging, but with the unconditional heart of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. So let's just sit quietly for a moment.